All right, so last week we started talking about the book of Revelation, and I wanted Anjanette to read that whole chapter because I want you to get kind of a sense of what the book of Revelation is. It's a wild ride, and it's just a little bit all over the place, so we're going to recap here a little bit. We're talking about all things new. This comes from that passage that we just read where it said that everything is being made new. And the book of Revelation is trying to get at for the readers, for the hearers, how does all of this get better? How does all of the troubles of the world get better? And so last week we talked about the story, and John, the writer, has written this book, this letter, and he titled it The Revelation of Jesus Christ. And we talked about how there's a lot of context that you need to actually understand all of the images that he used, and I gave this the subtitle, A First Century Jewish Christian's Hebrew Bible Scholar's Apocalyptic Dream Letter. And we talked about, like, if you are that person, then you get it, right? So much of this is images and pictures that a first century Jewish Hebrew Bible scholar would get. And this letter that he's writing is a dream. It's a vision. We talked about how when you're having a dream, you're in the cafeteria, and then all of a sudden you're up on top of the mountain with your friend who doesn't look like your friend, but you know it's them, and you don't know how you got there, right? The book of Revelation is a little bit like that. So we can tell one thing that about the passage we just read, when they were measuring all of those different things, to like they measured out how long and how tall and what the new city was made of. If you go back and you read the book of Leviticus, like the whole book is like that. So he is taking these measurements of what the old temple instructions were in the Old Testament and putting them on to this new city in this future that he's dreaming of. All right. We're going to do a little bit of recap because otherwise none of this makes any sense. So we talked about the different ways that people have typically read the book of Revelation. You can see it on this graph here. Are these events, are these things that he is describing that have happened in the past? Were they future for him, but now they've passed? Or are there things that are happening in the future? And then you see on the top, it says decipher. So this would be kind of like the books Left Behind, right? Where everything in the book of Revelation equals one thing in the real world, right? So a beast versus the beast, right? Versus this poetic view, which is kind of the way where he is describing something and he's hoping that you'll take the characteristics of the thing that he's describing and see that kind of as a poetic lens. So Revelation can be a new way of seeing everything. He's telling this story. He's telling this story to his readers, to his hearers, about what kind of story they're living in. And this is what we covered last week. What kind of story was it that we were reviewing? Does anyone remember? It was an encouraging story, and that's what we're going to talk about today. But it was a gospel story, right? It wasn't this David and Goliath story where the little guy beats up the giant, right? It wasn't this Cinderella story or the Superman story where the hero comes and swoops in and saves the day. It was a gospel story. And this was from chapter 4 and 5 that we read last week, where evil is strong and chaos is ruling. And that's kind of where they're living right now. And you have this expectation that a mighty, mighty one's going to come and going to save the day. But in reality, what ends up happening in the story, in these cycles, in these stories in Revelation, is there is a humble and sacrificial gift of love. And then good appears to be defeated, but then in the end, evil is overcome by goodness. So last week we looked, this is the cycle that was repeating over and over again in the book of Revelation. So you can see from a distance this cycle of story that John is trying to tell his readers. But what if you were going to pick up Revelation, like read it for yourself? Maybe we should talk about some of the main characters. So that's what we're going to do today. But Joey is right. Another element of the book of Revelation is that it was written as an encouragement to continue in faithful endurance. So you can, I'm giving you some examples from the book. John at the very beginning says, "I am your brother in tribulation, in patient endurance that are in Jesus." He is a pastor, and he is writing this to the churches that he's pastored. So he knows these people. And he's saying things like, "I know of your toil and your patient endurance." And then, "Don't fear what you're about to suffer." I was talking to Marquette about this, and I cannot imagine telling someone that. I can't imagine someone that I know going through something, and all I can say is, "Don't fear, it's going to hurt." Right? Like that, that's painful. That hurts. He really thinks these people are in trouble. "You dwell near Satan's throne and are a faithful witness even when you're killed. I know your love, your works, your faith, your patience, and your endurance." All right, here's this one. "Get it together. Wake up, pay attention. You have patient endurance in trials. I love you, so I'm going to correct you. Your faith is shallow." So 5 out of 7 ain't bad. But these are who John is writing the book of Revelation to. And all of them are really struggling. All of them are in real danger. And so when you are speaking to a group of people who are in real danger and in real trials, how do you inspire that group of people to continue on doing what they're doing when it's causing them suffering? That's what the book of Revelation is all about. Like, how do we continue? How do you continue in a hard time to continue to be faithful? And then how does all of this resolve? How does this get better? So today, what we skipped to the end of the book. This beautiful picture that John is painting of his vision of the future. And these are also images from the Old Testament. He's resolving some of the things that have previously been problems. All right, so this is the church. They're on a path, right? And instead of talking about what's in the middle first, we're going to talk about what's at the end. So John is painting this picture to try to produce endurance in these people, to try to encourage them to remain faithful. This is what that could look like. No sea. Does anyone care about that one? There's no ocean. Okay, here's why this is important, and this is my actually favorite thing. In Genesis 1, the Spirit of God hovered over the chaotic waters. And out of the chaotic waters, the goodness of God brought the stability of land. And then all throughout the Old Testament, the theme of water is chaos. And so when Jesus calmed the waters, that was like a huge deal. So this image of water, imagine standing by the ocean, and this chaos keeps coming. It just keeps coming at your heels, and you're trying to keep it at bay. That's the image that these people have of the sea. So in this good future, there's no sea. There's no encroaching chaos and turmoil that just keeps coming and keeps coming and keeps coming. Wave after wave after wave. Isn't that lovely? No sea. All right. He also says there will be no separation. So this is said when he says there's no temple. The heaven and earth, there's just kind of like a going back and forth between heaven and earth. There's no separation anymore between the physical and the spiritual. God walks among the people as was always meant to happen. So this, the separation of this good and evil and this spiritual and this flesh, it's not going to need, we're not going to need that anymore, right? We're all going to be whole. There's no night. So when you don't have any electricity, night is danger. It's when people sneak up and steal your stuff or take advantage, or when you are the most vulnerable. So if there's no night, there's no need to worry. There's no need to watch your back. And then he lists off, there's no tears, there's no hunger, there's no suffering. Just kind of in all the other things we worry about, we're going to lump them in there together. There's no deceit. So that long list of things that were like, well, these people aren't going to be there. It was all just like things that are untrue, you know, kind of what we call fronting, right? We're not, what you see is what you get. All right. And so what is there? Open gates. So I think we have this idea of sort of like judgment or something being who's in, who's out. But this beautiful picture of the future is just open gates, right? So there's no need to gatekeep anymore. John's beautiful picture of the future is open gates. Also, the water of life is given freely. So this renewing spirit of Jesus, it's not like for a price. So anyone who wants to can come. Anyone who wants this life can come, can have it. And this is actually in 22, but it talks about a fruit tree, that the fruit of this tree is the healing of the nations. It's just very beautiful. So this is the beautiful picture that John is trying to present to people who are suffering, who are having a hard time. Like, keep going. This is what we're looking forward to. When God has made God's home with all of us, and we are all in right relationship and completely whole, this is what we have to look forward to. So this is his dream. This is his dream that he's trying to inspire. All right, so we're going to back up a little bit, and we're going to talk about the thing in the middle. So the best thing that I can think of is when you're about to have a really important surgery, right? The doctor tells you, this is the outcome. Whatever it is that's been bothering you is going to be resolved. You're going to be able to run again. You're going to be able to jump again. You're going to feel 30 years old. Like, so the doctor paints this picture of like what your life will be like after the surgery, right? Or whatever the operation is. But then he's like, okay, but here are all the steps. Here's what's going to happen exactly in the surgery, this hard stuff that nobody's going to like. Here's what your recovery time is going to be like. So the middle is kind of bad, but they convince you to do it because they paint this beautiful picture of the end result. So that's what John's doing here. But in order to understand the book of Revelation a little bit better, we're going to talk about some of the main characters that I bet you've heard of these before. This is the middle part that Marquette referenced. Here there be dragons, this unknown part that we're going through. All right, so we're going to talk about the dragon in the book of Revelation, and we're going to talk about the beast. Have you guys heard of these characters? Scary folk. All right, that's my dragon. Revelations 12, 7 through 9. Then war broke out in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back, and he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. And the dragon was hurled down, and the ancient serpent was called the devil, or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to earth, he and his angels. So the dragon, in John's book, the dragon is why things are the way they are. Heaven is, in this vision of John, heaven is this beautiful place because the dragon is not there. The dragon was defeated in a cosmic battle, but still roams around Earth. So that's what's the cause of all of our problems here. In every religion, there has been some sort of embodiment of evil. There's been some putting a face and a name on this thing that we call evil. And I really love what Richard Rohr says. He's a Catholic priest. He says that if you don't give it a name, you don't take it seriously. If you don't give it a face, you don't take it seriously. So that's what's happening here with this dragon. If we can know a little bit about this dragon, hopefully we'll know what it's capable of and how we can best resist it. So if you've ever known a child who struggles with OCD, it can kind of be all-consuming for them. And one thing that I have learned about helping kids with who have OCD is to not let it shame them, but to kind of give them a way to take it outside of themselves, right? So you notice that a child is doing a repetitive behavior, and you say, "Hey, is that bossy monster bothering you?" Right? Instead of being like, "Hey, don't do that. Well, stop doing that." Right? You're able to like give this thing a name. And then you can say things like, "What do you think would make that bossy monster stop bothering you? Should we like go for a walk?" You know, it's this taking this struggle and putting it outside of ourselves. And it's the same thing with this dragon idea. But it's not always so unharmful, right? Like these are the things that we call like generational curses or addictions or hang-ups or our bad habits. This dragon comes from the Old Testament, from this cosmic battle that John mentioned, but also from the Garden of Eden is the very first time we see this in the Bible. It's the thing that makes us turn aside from what is good and prioritize something that is lesser. So John, remember, all of this is to help us see our reality differently. This is a picture that we had last week. Paul says something. "We are wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against authorities, against cosmic powers over this present darkness, against these spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." This dragon, we're able to see this thing that we all struggle with is what we're actually fighting against. So this person is not the real enemy. I love this little shadow, right? It allows us to see our reality different, the things that we're struggling with, and it also allows us to humanize and to love our enemy because they're struggling against it too. I'm sorry. I love him too, but it was the least scary one. I didn't know if there were going to be kids that were going to be afraid. All right, so we're going to talk about the beast. The beast is another main character of the book of Revelation. So Revelation 13:11-18, "Then I saw a second beast," so there's more than one, "coming out of the earth, and it had two horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. It exercised all the authority of the first beast and on its behalf, and it made the earth and the inhabitants worship the first beast. It performed great signs, even causing fire to come from heaven to earth in view of all the people. The second beast was given power, and everyone was commanded to worship it. It forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their forehead so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. That number is 666. So I think this is probably the most infamous passage in Revelation, where it talks about the beast, the number of the beast, and getting the mark of the beast. Yeah, but Revelation is such an interesting book, and the image of the beast is actually not that mysterious. John is doing a barely veiled political dig. So first, we're going to talk about the number of the beast is 666. So numbers and letters in the Hebrew language are, they both are the same, right? So there's one symbol that can be a number and the same symbol can be a letter. So for the number 666, if you make that a word, it literally is Nero, right? And so that's like not that, that's kind of dangerous. It's not that veiled at all, right? And he's like, hey, I hope you guys can figure this out. Like, it's the number of a person. It's 666. And also, in the Old Testament, the number 7 is perfect and complete, like the 7 days of creation. And so the number 7 and the number 6, like 666, means that it is not quite complete. It is falling short of what is perfect and complete. And so we can see this as like, it could be one person, it could be Nero, or it could be things like this. Now and in the past and in the future. So what are things like this beast? Another thing we know about the beast and the number of the beast is the placement. So we're going to put it on our hand and on our forehead. Does that jog anybody's memory? Yeah? Yeah. Heather went to seminary, so she doesn't get credit for that. Okay, it's called a phylactery in the Old Testament. They're little prayer boxes. Oh, it's not in the Old Testament, but it is from the Old Testament. So the Shema, the Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all of your might. And you shall bind them as signs on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. So if you see these little things that this guy has tied on him, on his forehead and on his hand, that is little prayer boxes. And inside the prayer boxes is this prayer. I will love the Lord, our God, with my heart, my soul, and all of my might. So if the beast is asking you to put something on your hand and on your forehead, it is demanding your allegiance. It is demanding that you love it with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. So what we know about the beast, then, from this. Right, yeah. Yeah, so that was the first beast and the second beast. So the beast, a beast, is powerful enough to create its own nearly good world. Right, so this is the 666 versus 777, right? It's not quite the dream. It's not quite the good world. It demands all love and allegiance above all else. Right? Sometimes this happens with groups, nations, and ideologies. When you are forced into a situation where it's this way or you're the enemy. Right? You can buy into all of the things that we're saying about how the world is and how we can make the world right, and you need to get on our team or leave, right? Those type of demands for allegiance are like a beast. Is that making sense? One of my favorite historical facts about the early Christian church is sometimes when they were martyred, the accusation against them was hatred for humanity. I've said this before, but on their paperwork of like why they were being punished was hatred for humanity. And the reason that they were accused of hatred for humanity is because they didn't believe that the superstitious things that the other people were doing were going to work. So they didn't participate. So everyone around them was doing these like sacrifices and these superstitious things. And the Christians wouldn't do that. And because they wouldn't do that, they got accused of hating all the people. Like, you must not like us. You must not like want us to prosper if you're not going to make these sacrifices and make these changes in your life that'll appease our gods. Isn't that so interesting? So the beast is an interesting image of evil, but it's not that complex. It's anything that tries to create its own good world, separate from this good vision that God has given through Jesus. And it is something that demands total allegiance. So how does all of this get better, this beast and this dragon? So Jesus has one way, and a beast has another way. All right, so at this point, when we know we've got a few of these enemies, right, we have the dragon, which is our own personal demons, right? We've got this thing that we're always fighting against, and everybody's got it. And then we've got this beast that is kind of this, like, collective. The collective of all everybody's dragons have hardened into a beast, right? How do we win, I think, is the question that we want to ask. But unfortunately, that's not how the book of Revelation works. And the question instead is how do we remain faithful? Because if we look at the elements of a gospel story, evil is strong. We expect, so this is the dragon, the beast. We expect for there to be something that comes and rescues us. But in reality, a humble, sacrificial gift of love. So this is kind of where the churches are at in the book of Revelation, is they're just suffering. They're losing, right? Like in human terms, they're literally being killed, and they're not making, like, political progress, right? They're not winning or defeating any of these monsters in terms of the world, right? But how do they continue to remain faithful even when good appears to be defeated? I think that's the question, right? That's what the book of Revelation is all about. How do we continue to remain faithful to this way of Jesus, which is addressing our own dragon, and continuing to address my personal dragon? Because if we take up arms and start to fight or try to fight other people's dragons, we just become a beast. We become the thing we're fighting against. And so this is the challenge of the book of Revelation, is to endure without becoming the enemy, without becoming the thing that is causing the problem. Is that encouraging? It's tough. It's really tough. It's really tough. All right. So let's just meditate on John's vision, on his dream. What does the book of Revelation do for us? For me, it makes me grateful. Man, it's not that bad. You know, the thing that I'm fighting against is not someone outside with a weapon, you know, right now. I haven't had any family or friends that have been killed or martyred, you know. So for me, it makes me grateful, but it also reminds me to pray and to pay attention, to not be distracted by the dragons and the beasts, and to not be co-opted into some other type of allegiance, where we go and fight other people's dragons, right? So what is it for you? What has surprised you about the book of Revelation? This we're just going to kind of discuss now. What has surprised you? What have you read on your own? Or what is it about this list that is most inspiring to you? Anybody have any thoughts?
Hasn't the temple been destroyed when John was writing the Revelation?
Sorry?
The temple. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. In the, like, the 70s. Yeah. I think you're probably right.
So these were not only persecuted Christians, they were persecuted people.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And he was on the Isle of Patmos. Have you been to the Isle of Patmos?
I have not. You have been, haven't you? Yeah. This is Jan's dream. Typo. Anything else stick out to you? Yeah, John.
Yeah, I like how, well, it's comforting for me that even back then people were talking about, like, the real issue right now is the system that is creating these things that's hurting us. Even in that little image of the imperial soldier stabbing the guy, but there's this demon behind him.
Yeah.
And it's, I feel like people that have been on the receiving end of, like, a system that just doesn't care about you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that is super interesting, if you go back and read Revelation 13, where it talks about the beast, when it starts to talk about the beast, it says that the beast gets all of its power from the dragon, which is just so interesting. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah. 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 That was my hope, is that I love the book of Revelation. It's so fascinating. I don't spend a lot of time in it, but I want it to be accessible. I want people to not think that it's this really weird book that got tacked on there at the end, but it's actually this really beautiful kind of culminative story of the gospel. Yeah.
It's a competition between the things of the earth.
Right.
The Romans and the things that we should be focused on.
Right, yeah. So imagine, if you go back and read through Revelation, imagine seeing all of these, like, chaotic battles happening, and your only job is to, like, keep walking. Right? Like, it's just all distraction. Yeah. It's written as an encouragement, and so if it's not acting as that, we're reading it wrong. Let's see what else we got here. All right. Well, let's go ahead and say a prayer and wrap up. Thank you guys for paying attention and for being ready to learn and riding along on this kind of, like, dense topic. Let's pray.